watch you leave me, babe. Most of all, I just don't wanna be free, no.
Once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And before we introduce our first guest, Natalie Goldberg, I want to say hi to my new friends at Lindsay Summit and Toussaint Center. And the wonderful thing, one of the wonderful things about having a book out is going to speak to groups and meeting new friends. And that's been happening a lot lately. So hi to all of you out there. My guests today are Natalie Goldberg, author of The Great Failure, A Bartender, A Monk, published by Harper's San Francisco. Oh, sorry, A Monk and My Unlikely Path to Truth. Now, see, I'm trying to read my own typing here, and I'm having a problem. And the book is published by Harper's San Francisco. Patrick Smith will be up later. He's author of Ask the Pilot. First up is Natalie Goldberg. Natalie is the author of 10 books, including Writing Down the Bones, which has sold well over 1 million copies and has translated into 12 languages. She's also written Long Quiet Highway, Thunder and Lightning, and just a whole slew of other wonderful books. For the last 30 years, she's practiced Zen and taught seminars in writing as a spiritual practice. She lives in northern New Mexico, and she is here to talk about The Great Failure, A Bartender, A Monk, and My Unlikely Path to Truth, published by Harper San Francisco. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Barbara. It's nice to be talking to you.
Thank you for coming on the show. Would you talk about The Great Failure and how this book came to be?
Well, I wrote a glowing memoir about my Japanese Zen master that I studied with for 12 years that came out in 1993 called Long Quiet Highway. And then when Katagiri died in 1990, 6 years after he died, it came out that he'd been sleeping with some of his students. And so I had to fulfill my commitment to continue to tell the truth in writing. So I couldn't leave Long Quiet Highway as it is. Though what I wrote in there is still completely true, I had a larger vision. And I wanted to explore how do you hold someone that you really love who also betrayed you? We often do a black and white. Either we grab the love part or the betrayal. I wanted to understand how we can embrace both and hang out in the gray area, which is really closer to where human life is.
So before you wrote The Great Failure, after you found out what you found out and knew that you had to write about it, how much did you know about what the book would become? Did you know where you were headed? Did you have an ending, or was it a path of discovery for you? How did it go?
Well, that's a good question. In 1996, when I found out, I didn't know at all, and I actually was in no place to really look at it deeply. and understand it. I mostly went into a real reaction of grief, a lot of anger, a lot of remorse, a lot of denial. But when I finally started writing it 3 years ago, I actually didn't know. I took a leap and put my father, I juxtaposed my father, who I also loved and who had betrayed me, and who was a bartender and the bouncer at his bar on Long Island. And I juxtaposed the two of them. And then on top of that, I kind of, it sounds very complicated, I wove through these Taishan Zen koans from 9th century China. And it just flashed on me to do this, but really, not till maybe 2 weeks before the book was done, and it took me 3 years to write it, did I realize that it would really work. So I had to, in a sense, in writing the book, hang out in that gray area I was talking about, not with no surety.
Yeah, and you, I love that layering of that story within this one, and also, and you, of course, touch on writing, little glimpses into the writing process, too, which is, it's lovely the way it comes in.
Thank you.
Now, at the same time, it's such a bittersweet story. Were you surprised at all at the emotional sort of aspects of the story, or how you would feel about writing about your father and, well, your Zen master, a longtime mentor?
Well, you know, writing is a great journey, I guess, and that sounds a little bit cliched, but really, for me, writing is the act of discovery. If I knew everything before I started the book, I probably wouldn't write the book. It would be boring. But yeah, the level of emotion was really strong. And you know, as a writer, though, you can't be tossed away by that. You still have to put down the details and the story and let the writer have the feelings. So I could feel as a writer, I mean, the reader have the feelings as they read it. So I could feel as I'm writing, but I have to get the experience across to the readers. And I can't do that by just saying, I feel sad, my heart is broken, oh, I really love them. They wouldn't know, be any closer to who these people are. I had to get that out of the way and get down to detail.
Yeah.
And story.
And story, because beautiful writing without story is beautiful writing without story.
Yes, exactly. It goes no place.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Natalie Goldberg, author of The Great Failure, published by Harper San Francisco. Talk about telling the truth. A lot of beginning writers have a big problem with being worried about having people looking over their shoulder when they're writing a story they need to write, but they're worried about who's going to read it and what they're going to think.
Yeah, it's a very tricky thing because writers are dying to be read and understood and listened to, and at the same time, we're afraid to be read, understood, and listened to. So it's a real kind of polarity going on. But finally, what we need to do is, even if it's scary and maybe it's not appropriate right then to publish something, at least write it out. And then you'll make some decisions around it. But the other thing that I found out is, you know, we're always protecting someone. But actually, we don't know really what their response will be. They might have a completely different response than we think. And what I've also learned is that often we think we're protecting somebody else, but we're really protecting ourselves.
Will you say more about that in terms of protecting ourselves by not writing truthfully or honestly?
Yeah, because we're afraid we'll lose love. But the truth is, when we only gain love by not being who we are, it's a twisted fate anyway, and it doesn't really work. So finally, we have to stand up and say what we say, and it will give people a chance to know us better and either they'll become more intimate with us or they'll hate us. It's kind of the chance you take. It's also a chance to see for them to see us better and to maybe, in my case, know who a woman is, know who I am.
Mm.
So we take that chance in human life, or we stay distant all the time. But I think writing, and really Zen practice for me, is having an intimacy with the world.
Mm. Will you read to us?
I'd love to.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and Natalie Goldberg's about to read from The Great Failure, A Bartender, A Monk, and My Unlikely Path to Truth.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So this is when me trying to teach my parents to sit meditation. The very first time my parents challenged my Zen life happened in New Mexico, that land of coyotes, sage, dirt roads, wood stoves. Absurd things, but because their daughter was there, Ben and Syl Goldberg schlepped out from Brooklyn. They're visiting me in my new home in Santa Fe. Already they've let me know I've gotten a bad deal on the house. I paid much too much. Now in the cool late July afternoon, we're sitting on the porch. Amazingly, we're not eating. We're sitting in a line. I'm in the middle. Hey, Nat, my father begins. What is meditation, anyway? It's hard to explain, I say. Then, because I am still incredibly foolish, I have a brilliant, daring idea. Do you want to try? And before they can answer, I run into the house and get a bell. Accoutrements, I think, will make it official. Okay, when I ring the bell, you just sit and feel your breath go in and out at your nose. If your mind wanders, just bring it back gently to your breath. We'll sit for 10 minutes. Okay, they both say, suddenly eager. This will be fun. And they wriggle in their chairs to compose themselves. The bell sounds 3 times, and we settle into this most ordinary thing. People breathing next to each other. My father is on my right, my mother on my left. I cannot believe this is happening. This must be what heaven is. The time is up. I ring the bell once to mark the end of meditation. Well, how was it, I ask? Did you have a lot of distractions? My father shrugs his shoulders. What's the big deal? Well, did you discover how much you think? Was it hard to concentrate? No, I didn't have a single thought. None, I asked, surprised. Not a one. Well, did you feel peaceful? Not particularly. It was like how it always is when you don't talk. That's why human beings talk. Nothing is happening otherwise. I turned to my mother. I was aggravated the whole time about your friend. She must think I'm awful. The night before, my mother had blurted out at dinner that she thought the chapters of my novel were awful, and my friend, who was there, told me later that my mother was jealous. I had confronted my mother that morning, and she apologized profusely. I don't know what came over me. Your chapters are lovely. Let's try again, my mother says. This time I'll do it right. I start to explain there's no right or wrong, but instead just say, okay. This time I want to ring the bell, my father says, grabbing the stick. He ceremoniously hits the bell 3 times. We're sitting for 2.5 minutes when my father suddenly belts out, hello, Dolly. Well, hello, Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong, while ringing the bell continuously to accompany himself. Buddy, please, my mother tries to stop him, struggling to reach across me to grab the bell. But my father keeps going. He's having a ball. I'm the only one staring straight ahead at the high adobe wall, 100 feet in front of us, still attempting to notice my breath. I decide right then that I don't have to save my parents. They don't count as sentient beings. They're in another category entirely. I imagine the enlightened ones talk under the Bodhi tree. There are 10 kinds of beings, and now Buddha turns his head and addresses me personally. And Natalie, your father is the 11th kind out of this universe.
Thank you so much. That was Natalie Goldberg reading from The Great Failure, A Bartender, A Monk, and My Unlikely Path to Truth, published by Harper San Francisco. You have such a clean, crisp style, and it is full of detail. You don't say the couch, you say the green vinyl couch. You have detail throughout that you're not staring ahead, you're staring at the adobe wall. Talk about detail in writing, because it certainly makes it come alive, and when it's not there, something is missing.
It seems like everything is missing, because really what we want to give, really writing is a visual art. We want to give the reader a picture of what we're talking about, at least for me, because I am visual. But, you know, Nabokov said, caress the divine detail. And Mies van der Rohe, who is the famous architect, said, God hides in the details. Really, without detail, there's nothing. And when you look around, all of life is a detail, moment by moment.
Well, it's interesting what you just said. Writing is a visual art, because it is, and yet probably writers don't think of it this way. You know, they think of it as being emotional, as being, yes, descriptive, but not visual.
Yes, except that if it's just emotional or just descriptive, even hearing that word, I think about, you know, being taught by Mrs. Post in elementary school to describe something, and often it somehow gets dead. We have to get, you know, it's once again getting back to an intimacy, giving the picture of something, and maybe giving the sound of it and the feeling.
Yes.
But you can't give the feeling by just saying, it feels good. What kind of good? The good of a cucumber or the good of a chocolate?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. Wonderful to hear you say. How has your writing process changed since Writing Down the Bones? That was so many books ago. Do you still write in cafes? And
yes, I still write in cafes, and I still keep my hand moving. I really know nothing else but writing practice. And in my sixth book, Thunder and Lightning, I tell people how to take writing practice and take it from writing practice into forming essays and stories and novels. But really, always, writing practice is the fundamental practice for me behind everything. Keep your hand going.
And you have books on writing, memoirs, a novel, poetry, books on painting. Do you have a favorite form?
I guess memoir. In some ways, I'm always telling my story, no matter what I'm writing. If you look at Writing Down the Bones closely, you know things, you know, stories about my life. So in a way, I'm only looking for ways for people to pay attention and for me to tell them about my life. But, you know, sometimes when I was first out there, people didn't really care about Natalie Goldberg. So I thought, well, if I tell them how to write and then sprinkle it in, I'll get what I want. So it's kind of, I like telling memoir and also somehow Zen teaching together.
In memoir, how do you, like, for instance, in The Great Failure, you're putting forth dialogue that your parents spoke, that your Zen master spoke, the people in your life spoke years ago. How do you reconstruct dialogue in memoir and have it work in terms of being accurate?
Well, it can't be accurate, you know, like my father might have said something a little different, not, hey, Nat, what is meditation anyway? He might have said something like, tell me about meditation. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
You never can get the exact thing. If you look over your shoulder, the past is gone. The only place you carry it is inside you. So what I want to get more than just the exact word is get the sense of it, and for you to experience sitting there on that summer afternoon with the high adobe wall teaching my father and mother to meditate. So whatever I can do to get close to that, and often dialogue really helps with it.
Mm-hmm. Do you take notes along the way? Are you journaling, or are you doing writing practice and keeping copies of what you wrote in case later someday you might need it?
No. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do writing practice, and I write. But, you know, when that actually happened, it was an awful experience. I thought, there they are, pulling the rug out from under me again. But when I wrote about it years later, it was actually very funny and very exemplary of what the predicament was like with my father. You know, he was very eager and open. I fell in, and then he cut me at the knees.
Mm.
But at the same time, it was very adorable and funny.
Yeah.
So it was very tricky.
Mm.
But when it happened, it was only in writing it years later did I remember the incident and think it was important. When it happened, I think I wanted to forget it as quickly as possible.
Mm. And what about then revision? What sort of process of revision did the great failure go through? Do you wait till you have an entire draft before you go back and start messing with it, or is it a little bit along the way?
Both. I plunge through and try to get through a first draft, but also I do a little tinkering as I go along and try to refine it. So I reread and, you know, tinker around, and then I keep plunging ahead. So I do both. And really, you know, people always ask me, well, what do I do with this? What do I do with that? You know, this is my 10th book, and each book has its own process. So each book is different. For instance, my first three books, I almost wrote straight through and didn't do very much reworking. And then my novel, I reworked very much. The Great Failure, I did add on some things at the end and put some new things in. Each one is a different process, and you have to face something different with each book.
Do you begin books that you abandon, or when you begin a book, do you know that you're going to finish it? You know it's something you need to keep going on?
That's part of what it is when I talk about writing as a practice. If you start a book, you finish it. Even if it's a first draft, you have to go completely through it. Because otherwise, we create a habit of never finishing things. But I wait until there's enough heat and energy that I'm sure I have enough interest in this book that I'll hang in there under all circumstances and finish it. You know what I mean? I won't get just some little creative idea that doesn't have a lot of heat behind it and say, oh, I'll write a book.
Yes.
I really wait until something is powerful.
That you know you're going to carry through.
Yes,
through.
And really writing practice teaches you that, because you learn what your obsessions are, the things you keep coming back to over and over. And what you do with writing is you turn your obsessions into your deep pleasures. From your suffering into your pleasure.
Yes. Natalie, we're at the end of our time. Would you give our listeners, especially our beginning writing listeners, any words of wisdom?
Yeah. Continue under all circumstances and keep your hand going. Stop thinking about writing. Do it.
Thank you again for coming on Writers on Writing, and best of luck with this book.
Thank you very much.
It's a lovely book. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Natalie Goldberg, author of The Great Failure, A Bartender, A Monk, and My Unlikely Path to Truth, published by Harper San Francisco. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be with Patrick Smith, author of Ask the Pilot. Please stay tuned.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. I am Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we've been on since 5. Our first guest was Natalie Goldberg. We are back with Patrick Smith, author of Ask the Pilot, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, published by Riverhead Books. Patrick is an airline pilot and freelance writer. His air travel column appears weekly on Salon.com. He has flown both passenger and cargo jets and has visited more than 50 countries. He lives in Somerville, Mass. with his family. Hi, Patrick.
My family? I guess that means my salamanders.
That's right.
And my backyard bird.
That's it.
Cool.
Thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Talk about being a pilot and being a writer, because I think probably very few pilots are writers. I know one, and now I know two, and that's you and another friend.
Well, I think it is an odd combination, and one thing I've noticed is that the best flight-related reportage and nonfiction that I've come across tends to be inevitably from industry outsiders, which is to say writers, not pilots, who've infiltrated the industry and kind of picked out the most intriguing parts of it to write about. Because I think they're better able to find what nuances people will find meaningful. And my intentions were to kind of meet a need halfway. I wanted to be a pilot who understood what people were curious about, but at the same time had at least a halfway grasp of addressing it. You know, whether or not I'm talented or, you know, have a way with words really isn't essential to what I do.
But at the same time, no, and I, being one of those white-knuckle flyers, I probably would have read this book even if it wasn't written very well, because it's so interesting, but it is written well, and you definitely have a voice and a style, and I think it makes the information all that more appealing, because it's not just another dry book about flying. You know, it's just very fun and colorful.
I'm glad you put it that way. There have been a lot of books about quote-unquote flying, including others authored by pilots. But there hasn't been one from this particular angle that is, to use a sort of sappy word, thoughtful. And I think the way the book accomplishes that is by taking in the whole realm of air travel, not just technical discussions about aerodynamics and hydraulics and turbulence, because those are the things where past attempts at this have gotten caught up, just in kind of the gee whiz about flight, without really appealing to people's overall sense of curiosity about, you know, what makes life interesting and how flight, for example, relates to travel, you know, that's one of the things I constantly play up and evangelize about, is how, for me, flying and travel were the same thing. And to say which one inspired me to the other, I don't really know if it was a love of travel that turned me on to flight or a love of flight that turned me on to travel. It's kind of hard to say.
Did you fly a lot as a kid?
Well, I grew up kind of an airline brat in a family where one of my parents worked for an airline, and so I was, you know, able to fly around, you know, basically for nothing. And that kind of opened my eyes to the world. And again, you know, I would go to countries, and you know, the airplane to me was inherent to the journey. It was part of the experience. And I came to see flight and travel as one and the same thing.
Now, the structure of the book is interesting, and I quite like it. I like the questions and then your answers. Will you talk about how you came up with this structure?
Well, the book is based on the Salon.com column, mm-hmm. which started out, anyway, as a pretty straightforward Q&A. Readers would submit questions about flying, and I would adapt them a little bit if need be, and then answer them. And the book is a collection of kind of the most relevant of those questions and answers. Some of them are directly verbatim, and then others, like I said, are adaptations. And what I thought to do was to lay the book out basically as a Q&A, and then at the beginning of each chapter put in, you know, a more impressionistic piece, an essay or a firsthand anecdote, something like that, to just make it a little more lively and amusing.
Well, it is. You have some very amusing pieces in here. One in particular, perhaps the funniest story in the book, is and I didn't realize it was actually you when you started the piece, chapter 4, I guess, about putting ice, or flying a cargo plane and putting ice, extra ice, down the toilet, and it turned out to be dry ice.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a true story. I accidentally put a large brick-sized piece of dry ice into an airplane toilet, and unbeknownst to me, when you do that, the carbon dioxide in the dry ice mixes rather colorfully with the contents of the toilet. And, you know, the rest, I guess, you'll have to buy the book and read about. But it is a funny story, and what makes it even funnier is I get letters from people saying, oh, that story, I've read that. It's just an urban myth. And I'm like, it's not an urban myth. It happened to me. You know, I have the blue-stained shoes to prove it.
So if we look it up on Urban Legends, are we going to find this story?
I don't know if it's made it that far, you know, to Snopes or whatever.com, but that story has been posted all over the world on aviation websites and bulletin boards and whatnot. So a lot of people know about it, and a lot of people at this point think that it's, like I said, an urban legend.
Well, yeah, I found it really fun. And it was interesting. This book came to me at a time when I was beginning a book tour and having to fly, not by choice, but I've flown to India 3 times. I've flown, you know, but I haven't quite liked it very much. And so this sort of came at the right time, because you answer so many questions that I think people who are afraid do wonder about. But how does that make you feel as a pilot, knowing that you're flying a plane full of people that probably are just really, you know, scared witless?
Well, I don't know if they're scared witless. I think at this point people are more jaded by flying than they are afraid by it. And there's always a number of people who are genuinely anxious about flying. And, you know, that's just human nature. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, there is an inherent danger to flying. It's not a natural thing for people to do. So every one of us, when we get on a plane, from the most experienced crew member to a first-time flyer, does contemplate his or her mortality a little bit, and that's to be expected. And pilots don't look down on people for being nervous. At the same time, it's not anything that crew members really sit back and meditate on,
mm-hmm.
you know, thinking about the people in the back and what they're going through and what they're thinking. That's not your job, really. Your job is the instrument panel in front of you, and you know, getting in from one place to another in one piece.
How do people, I mean, we hear about airlines in third world countries, and sometimes we have occasion to fly on them. How should we be thinking about it? I mean, do you think flyers should do a ton of research to search out what are the safest airlines to go on and do it that way in a very rational way? Or, you know, if you have
No, I think you'd be wasting your time to do that. As a general rule, the vast, vast majority of foreign carriers are just as safe as ours. I might get shouted down a little bit for saying that, but you're really into statistical hair splitting when you start comparing foreign carrier safety to ours. Unless you're going to the absolute ends of the earth, I mean, you know, flying through the Sudan in a cargo plane, you're almost never going to come across anything that's in any way dangerous. In fact, some of the foreign carriers you'd least expect have some of the best safety records. A list of airlines that have been fatality-free for at least 30 years are, it's a pretty long list and includes names like Ghana Airways, Syrian Air, Air Jamaica. I mean, you know, airlines from, you know, what we call third world countries. One of my favorite examples is LAB, the airline of Bolivia. One of the poorest nations in the world, and yet they have this incredibly proud airline that I don't think has had a crash since the 60s. And even that, there's something about it that makes it kind of a, you know, whether or not it was really their fault. I've flown on in-country carriers in Burma, Turkey, Ecuador, Peru, and I've always found them to be remarkably professionally run.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Patrick Smith, author of Ask the Pilot, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, published by Riverhead Books. You have an interesting section in here, too, about pilots and how we may think of them as being cheap, but they really don't necessarily make a ton of money. And that was sort of surprising to me.
Well, what you hear from the media a lot are these examples of senior captains at the largest airlines and how much money they make, $250,000 a year or whatever. But you have to remember that those particular crew members make up a very small portion of all the pilots out there. And starting pay at the largest airlines is only about $30,000 a year, and at some of the smaller regional carriers, it's less than 20. And it can take you a long time. Remember, everything in the industry is based on the seniority system. And by the time you're making, you know, a respectable, well, depends what you mean by respectable, but, you know, what you would expect a pilot to be making, kind of conventional wisdom, you know, maybe you've been in the industry for 10, 15 years, and you're in your 40s or older, and, you know, the rewards come later, not sooner. My first job as a first officer, which is to say a co-pilot on a, you know, a multi-million dollar commuter plane, I made, and I'm not exaggerating, I think it was $920 a month. And that was only about 14 years ago. It's not a heck of a lot different now.
Well, you compare it to being, I don't know, an artist or an actor where it really is a love.
Sure, it's suffering for your art. A lot of pilots, they do it because they love it and, you know, because they wouldn't feel right doing something else. It's just not about the money.
Yeah.
I mean, that can lead down the road to, you know, self-exploitation and, you know, it drags the whole industry down when you have all of these people willing to do it for nothing. But, you know, that's part of what it is. That's the love of flying.
Yeah. I think it's early on in the book. You definitely made me chuckle when you talked about how white knucklers are, you know, takeoffs and landings are what makes us especially nervous. But that if you're going to be nervous, you shouldn't save it for the end. You should use it up at the beginning of the flight.
Well, again, I'll premise this by saying, once again, you're hair splitting. You have to remember that, you know, close to 30,000 flights take off and land every single day in this country alone, virtually every one of them safely. So having said that, if you have to be neurotic and be afraid at some point in the flight, takeoff is your moment, because it's an inherently more dangerous point than landing. Not by a lot, but that's the transition from ground to flight, which is a more precarious point than from flight to ground.
35,000 flights in this country daily. Where are they all? I mean, how is this airspace split up, you know? I mean, how can air traffic controllers keep track of
Nowadays, too, a lot of those flights are smaller planes, so regional jets, 50-seaters and whatnot. How do they do it? Well,
I mean, what if they all went out to lunch at the same time? Then what?
Or on strike?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that's going to happen. It extrapolates to about 60,000 around the world every day, by the way.
It's just kind of mind-boggling, you know. I mean, as an irrational flyer, you think, well, what's going on, you know? Do I have to look out the window and keep track? And you know, if you see a jet going, you know, close enough to see it, far but close enough, you think, well, what's it doing so close? And then you think, 35,000.
Well, not just that, but in the terminal area, you know, as you know, all flights leave from and arrive at the airport, and so everybody kind of like a hub and spoke. You know, flights are all more or less going to and coming from the same places, so it's not at all unusual to see another plane from your own. But you also have to remember that those flights are being watched by air traffic controllers, and there's also equipment on the planes that allow crews to see each other. That's just par for the course. In some airports, San Francisco comes to mind, the runways are laid in parallel, and they're somewhat close together, and you can be on the final approach course and have another jet just, you know, a couple of miles off to the side, you know, close enough to read the livery on the side. And that might be kind of striking if you're not expecting it, but it's totally normal, and those parallel approaches are being monitored by several controllers and the crew members.
Well, speaking of striking, what about lightning? What about when you're flying in a storm? How should you be thinking about that?
Well, you're not going to be flying in a storm. Pilots are pretty well trained to avoid going into storms. You could be relatively near a storm and see lightning. I remember once flying as a passenger going to Singapore, and there was lightning all around, and I was just thinking, hey, this is pretty cool. Because I knew you could see from the distance that we weren't anywhere actually near these thunderheads, and it just became kind of a visual display. Worst comes to worst, planes are occasionally hit by lightning, and they're built with that in mind. And no, the energy will not come roaring down the center aisle like a fireball and electrocute you. The planes are built so that the energy is just discharged overboard. I don't know of any accidents caused by lightning since, I want to say, the 1950s, if that gives you any idea of how much of a non-event it usually is.
Well, again, I think in, you know, reading your book, and it, as I said, it came at such a great time in my life, it came in the mail, just a wonderful time, to address so many things that sort of I'm thinking, I'm not so afraid of it anymore. And it's, you know, It's good. Good.
That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to communicate that safety and security, but to do it somewhat articulately. And then also, at the end of the book, and tell me if it worked, I want the person to put the book down and think that they feel safer, better informed, and also at the same time kind of rejuvenated about flying, maybe excited about it. Maybe the next time you go out to the airport, you'll look for something and notice something maybe you didn't notice before.
I did feel that way. I definitely felt that way. And it was a pleasure to actually feel that way. Even turbulence, you kind of make some sense of turbulence, which is one of those things that you can never avoid on planes, and it probably makes people, most people, jumpy.
Well, it does, and the problem that people, what people don't seem to understand is that turbulence is not something that is abnormal. It's not a problem. It's just part of the sky, like the wind and the clouds. And on any given flight, you are going to hit a measure of turbulence, whether it's, you know, barely noticeable or serious. Just, you know, often you don't know until you're up there. But it's something that is going to happen, that is inherent to the sky, and is not in and of itself a safety factor. There have been cases when really bad turbulence has injured passengers, usually because they weren't seated and belted in as they were supposed to be at that time. And there also have been very rare cases where turbulence has damaged airplanes. I don't know about actual crashes caused directly by turbulence, strictly speaking. There may be one or two in modern times. I mean, that those numbers should speak for themselves if we're talking 30,000 flights a day.
I was, today I was listening to the radio. There was a report on NPR about, you know, just the added security measures that have been taking place since 9/11 and how these machines, x-ray machines, that our goods, our baggages run through, in this last year found, you know, located, oh, this incredible amount of firearms, bullets, knives, and all of that. These are very complicated machines and very expensive machines. Do all airports have these now?
I'm not sure which machines you're talking about. There are machines that we put our hand luggage through, and then there are machines that x-ray your checked baggage looking more specifically for explosives. And I don't know what they're finding. Corkscrews, nail files. I mean, I find that whole aspect of it to be sort of preposterous, to be honest with you.
Well, you mentioned something in your book that I liked, and you said that terrorism will always be, what did you say, sort of a very low-tech, essentially. I mean, very
right.
Kind of...
I mean, even with September 11th, when you really look at all of the planning that went into that, it was a very low-tech affair.
Yeah.
And it's always going to be that way. You know, here we are worrying about iris scans and all of these sort of high-tech solutions to what is always going to be a very low-tech problem. And it's just, it's time to, I mean, first of all, it's time to get over September 11th as far as it having been an attack on air travel. I mean, terrorism has always been there. I mean, air travel has always been a high-profile target for sabotage going back to, you know, the 60s and 70s with hijackings to Havana, and then we had the Air India and Pan Am bombings. And, I mean, that's always going to be there, and that's not to suggest that times are dangerous, just the opposite. It's to highlight how we've always had these risks, and yet the numbers have always been overwhelmingly on our side. It's kind of ironic because since September 11th, our anxieties have been more tightly wound than ever, and yet the past 3 years have been the safest in commercial aviation history.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't had a serious accident in North America since the crash outside of Kennedy Airport in November of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a remarkable stretch, and yet we're at the same time probably more fearful than ever, which makes no sense. But part of that comes from the spectacle of security at the airport, the lines, and, you know, which is mostly just posturing, if you ask me. I mean, I think we need to get away from the kind of scrap metal confiscation that goes on, you know, taking people's hobby knives and whatnot. You know, that really doesn't have much to do with actual security.
Yeah, when I was going through one California airport last week, I was really I might have even been chuckling because they were really examining this guy, this this guy who looked so unlike anyone who would ever cause any trouble for anybody because they couldn't find whatever was causing the metal detector to go off. And it seemed like a great misplacement of energy.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, it's a definite misallocation of resources. I mean, instead of putting more money into, say, just general intelligence or explosives detection, we're wasting money at the metal detectors taking sewing needles from people. And part of that is because we're so fixated on the September 11th boilerplate, you know,
yes.
the skyjacking takeover that's almost guaranteed never to happen again because, you know, at the time it was something we'd never seen before, and I don't think any hijacker could get anywhere near the cockpit at this point, considering.
Now, you have a website. Do you want to give out the address?
Easy enough. It's askthepilot.com. And Ask the Pilot, of course, is the name of the book and also the column on salon.com, which runs every Friday. You can order the book through the website and also read a little bit about it and samples from it.
You also do counseling. You do... people can, fear of flyers can call you?
And, yes, there's a little bit on the website about that, and if you email me through there, I could send you some detailed information about how that works.
Is there any place you especially love to fly?
Well, love to fly or love to travel?
Fly.
Fly.
Yeah. Or a particular time of day or a particular season? Or
I don't know. There was always something for me when I was flying cargo jets about going over the North Atlantic, particularly at sunrise. But like anything else, like a favorite song or your favorite food, it just kind of depends what state of mind you're in and what you're in the mood for. And I mean, I have my favorite places to go, but...
Which are?
Maybe not necessarily to fly to. Oh, I don't know. We could do a whole hour and a half on travel. Just, you know, like I was saying, one kind of fed the other and kind of turned me on to the idea of seeing in the world. And you mentioned you'd been to India, and since being furloughed, I've done a good bit of traveling to India and Egypt and Turkey and Botswana and here and there and trying to see what I can.
Any last words for our listeners who are readers, writers, and travelers?
Well, for the flyers and travelers, it's Thanksgiving is coming, and this is the busiest travel push of the year. And if you're going out to the airport this year, I mean, keep in mind that airfares are the lowest that they've been in history, and we're the safest we've been in history. And when you're languishing in line to have your shoes x-rayed, as horrible as it is, try to look around a little bit and just notice something, whether it's an interesting livery on the side of an airplane or the architecture of the terminal, just something interesting, and meditate on that for a minute and realize that flying can still be exciting and cool.
That's great. You know, this last trip I took, or the last few trips, what I did, too, because I realized that one of the worst aspects for me of traveling or flying was the whole shoe deal, you know, taking off my boots, standing there. So I just put them in a carry-on bag, and I wore these shoes you could see through, you know, so that I didn't have to take my shoes off.
Well, and all of that because one guy, one time, had the idea of putting whatever it was he put in his shoe. I mean, just imagine how much worse it could have been.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, sometimes it's like, what's the thing that bugs you? Can you do anything about it? Do something about it? And the whole trip is more enjoyable. I really appreciate you coming on, taking the time. It's been a pleasure. Your book is wonderful. I did end reading it with feeling sort of lighter about the whole deal, and that's what I was hoping for, so...
Well, no, it's been a pleasure, and again, everybody come over to askthepilot.com. You can read more about it and kind of get a sense of what it is in the way I was trying to explain before about how it's not strictly a book about flying, per se, but
No. Kind
of takes in these bigger issues and kind of more interesting things and facets.
Yes, I loved it. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was Patrick Smith, author of Ask the Pilot. Again, he's at askthepilot.com. And I love this book. And I check it out. If you have any qualms about flying or just really curious about the whole deal with travel and the air, do check it out. Oh, what can I tell you? I can tell you that we're out of time. And if you need to know more, go to my website at panonfire.com. This Saturday, I'll be somewhere in Fountain Valley, the Southern California Writers Association. And the info is on my website. And I want to leave you with a quote by Anne Frank, who said, "Think of all the beauty that's still left in and around you and be happy." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.
Funny Valentine.